The following podcast is an exclusive presentation of Project Entertainment Network.
Hey, this is Jamie Engel of Origins, a bi-weekly podcast that shares the story behind legends and lore, where myth and science meet. If you like stories with a supernatural slant, get your bi-weekly fix every Monday at 4 when I share the origins of things that go bump in the night, urban legends, classic monsters, and current sightings of those creatures who normally hide in the shadows. Plus, each chapter features a short story related to the bi-weekly topic. So go ahead and subscribe, binge, and grab some amazing swag through Project Entertainment Network on Patreon. And if you want to nerd out on transcripts and book links, head over to podcastorigins.com.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of Monster Attack, the podcast dedicated to old monster movies. You know, from time to time, we talk about films that I sort of categorize as classic cult films, and the movie that we're going to be talking about this week is definitely one of those. We are talking about 1953's Robot Monster. You know, I'm sure a lot of you that listen to the podcast are wondering, when was he going to get around to some of these classic cult films like Robot Monster? Well, it just seemed like today was the right day to do it. We're just coming off of Christmas, and we've got New Year's coming up after this podcast is released. And I hope everyone, I'm going to say right now, I hope you have a very, very happy New Year and a very safe New Year's Eve. And we're looking forward to, we're very, very close, folks. We're only three episodes away from our third anniversary show and getting ready to start our fourth season on Monster Attack. And again, as I've been saying the last few weeks, I thank you so much for the support you have shown us these last 3 years. It has been absolutely incredible. And I hope you continued enjoying the show for as long as I can find movies to talk about from my childhood. This one, I'll tell you, folks, this is going to be the hardest show that I do because so much has been done on Robot Monster. So many books have been written about it and television shows and documentaries and things. Trying to think of things that people have not said about this show is going to be a little difficult. But I'm just going to share my experience with this movie, and I hope it sort of mirrors some of the experiences you've had with it. I'm sure for those of you that have seen this movie, we all remember the first time we saw Robot Monster. And we either scratched our head going, what in the world did we just see? Or laughed at it or had a lot of fun with it. I'm one of those people that had a lot of fun with this movie. Even going back and watching it again, I just watched it yesterday to get ready to record this podcast. I had forgotten, you know, that it is fun and it is very goofy. And what a movie. Now, there's a lot of people, there have been, you know, a lot of books that have been written, a lot of people that say, this is the worst movie ever made. I would say, no, I don't agree with that. Just as though a lot of those people say that about a lot of Ed Wood films, I would not say, no, this is not the worst film ever made. It's not a great movie, but then again, it depends on what your definition of great is. Because if you were a backer of this film, as far as a financial backer, an investor, this is a pretty great movie. Believe it or not, this movie made a ton of money on its initial release. You know, a lot of people say, well, yeah, of course it made money over the years because it gained a reputation through the Medved brothers and their 50th worst films of all time, the Golden Turkey Awards and all that. No, I mean, in its initial release, this movie made a lot of money. How much money did it make? Well, it was made for $16,000. Amazing. And this is a 3D movie. It was originally shot in 3D. It's amazing that they were able to do this film for $16,000 and shoot it in 3D. And one of the producers, when he was asked about that years later, said, yeah, that added about another $4,800 to the budget. So it's amazing what they got for their money on this one. It grossed $1 million when it was released in the theaters. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. That is one of the biggest turnarounds that that anyone had ever seen in 1953. And the sad part is that Phil Tucker, who was the director, didn't get much money off of this at all. In fact, he claimed for years that he didn't get any money at all for making this, for directing this film. And if that is the case, that's pretty sad. In fact, Phil got so depressed by the critical reviews that he got for this movie that he attempted suicide, unsuccessfully, luckily. But the critical reaction just really, really upset him, because at the time, you know, he was around a crowd that thought he was, you know, a real up and coming director. He'd already had directed one feature length film, and this one he was producing and directing, and people were expecting a lot of him. And he really thought that some of the things he foresaw in this film would come to pass and people would like it. But it got an interesting reception. I mean, the critics did not like this film at all. But it had a lot of things about it that were sort of first time. I mean, the fact that it was in 3D. And it also was the first time that a film used stereo sound in a theater. This one was released with a stereo soundtrack. It also had a pretty good guy doing the music for him. Bernstein did the music for this film. And Elmer was a cool guy. I mean, you know, we've talked about him quite a bit on this show, but he was the kind of guy that he loved helping out projects that might not have been considered very, very important. And that's what he said about the Monster Attack. Yeah. What he said about Robot Monster when asked, you know, why did someone of your quality do the soundtrack for this film? He said, you know, I just like helping movies out. I figured I could help out. And the soundtrack of this is pretty good. It is pretty good. Well, we've talked about Phil Tucker, and unfortunately didn't do much after this. I mean, he directed 9 films in his career. He was known as a writer, produced a little bit, did a little bit of everything in the film industry. But this, unfortunately, will always be his legacy. People remember him for Robot Monster. Now, folks, again, as goofy as this film is, and I'm going to talk about some of the problems I had with this film, it's not the worst film ever made. And this is one of those, I'm going to tell you in the beginning of the show, grab a bunch of people with a lot of popcorn and have some fun watching it some night at home. It's a fun movie. It's very easy to find copies of this film. And surprisingly, most of the copies that are out there and available are in pretty good shape. They have been restored very well. Years ago on VHS, this film was released in its original 3D, and then you would get and they gave you the glasses with the VHS tape, and it played decently, but I have a feeling the 3D probably played a lot better in the theater than it would on TV. But I have a 3D version of it still, and it's not bad. It's a little fuzzy in some places, but it's still not bad. Now, here are the people that you're going to see in the movie. If by chance you have not seen Robot Monster, I will tell you, I want you to go see it. Don't spend any money, necessarily a lot of money, but just, you know, try to find a way to go see it. There are streaming services out there. They might even be available on Netflix and some of those. I don't subscribe to any of them, so some of you out there may know, but a lot of times it's easy to find cult films on you know, Netflix and Hulu and some of those services. So check it out, because you're bound to find a pretty good copy of this film floating around. Our star in the movie, an interesting guy too, is George Nader. And George Nader plays, you know, sort of the lead male in this. He's the heartthrob. He's seen a lot without a shirt on. He's got a ripped t-shirt in this because it is an end of the world type picture. And George Nader, interesting guy. He was signed by the studio that also signed Rock Hudson and some of these other guys. And unfortunately, George got caught in the crossfire of of a lot of pretty boys with this studio and was relegated to playing in a lot of B pictures and a lot of supporting roles in small pictures. One of the things that the studio used him for was to cover up the fact that Rock Hudson was gay, because George Nader was gay. And he was one of the first actors back then in the 50s to come out of the closet. And he came forward. And, back then they had a magazine called Confidential. Confidential looked for any dirt they could find on celebrities. It was, one of the very, very first really nasty tabloids that came out on the market. And George went on to say later on in his life, every week that Confidential came out, because it was a weekly publication, he said there were a few actors on the lot that were scared that they might be the subject of one of the articles that came out in Confidential. George beat him to the punch and just came out and admitted that he was gay. And the studio used that to their advantage. And of course, as many of you know about Rock Hudson and his history, Rock Hudson's, situation didn't really become public until near his death when he contracted AIDS. He and George were very good friends, even though George was sort of, didn't have much of a career in order for Rock Hudson to have a pretty good career. They were very, very good friends. And George, one of George's, companions was very good friends with Rock Hudson as well. George ended up doing some films in Europe when he couldn't get a whole lot of work here in the United States. But, big, tall, strapping guy. And they always took advantage of his build. He was 6'1", 180 pounds. He definitely kept himself in shape, had a good physique. And they exploited that. And Phil Tucker exploited it in this movie by, he had a couple of major scenes where he didn't have a shirt on. And we could talk a little bit about that later on when we get into the storyline a little bit. Our lead female, our romantic female, and our opposite of Roy, playing a character by the name of Alice, is Claudia Barrett. Now, Claudia is another interesting gal, not real well known. And she, her career was, sort of hit and miss. She ended her career pretty early on. I mean, she stopped acting in 1964, and she got a little frustrated that she wasn't getting a whole lot. Some of the big things, she did a bunch of Westerns and The Public Defender, a big courtroom drama back then, but ended up basically doing a ton of television, some of the old TV shows like The Jack Benny Show and some of those that were popular in the early 50s. Did a lot of Westerns, did 77 Sunset Strip, some of those, and she got sort of tired of the TV scene and not being able to do the big films, and became a very successful artist. And again, for a short career, she was under contract with Republic Pictures, but just never really did much, so she got out of the business in 1964. And, very pretty gal, so she, was the girl next door type, the very pretty girl next door type. I got to say, her acting in this was a little over the top, and I don't know if that's how she was directed or if it was a fault of the script, but she's a little over the top in this. Especially, they've got a big scene in this film between Roy and Alice that is one of the more laughable scenes in the movie. Again, let's introduce everybody else, and then we'll get to that. Selena Royal is our next character, and very sort of a sad situation with her. She plays the mother in this. She plays Alice's mother and then the mother of the two children that we're going to talk about here in the film. Selena was off and running on a very, very good career, and she got implicated in the communist hearings, the Red Witch Hunt, as they called it back then, the McCarthyism and stuff, and she was implicated in this. She went for years and years trying to clear her name. By the time she did, the damage had already been done. And it's a shame that basically lost her career over that, but pretty competent actress. And she was quite a good looker in the 30s when she first made her way into the film industry. And by this, she's still a very, very attractive gal. She was used to playing later on in her career motherly types and that sort of, attractive older women. But the McCarthy thing really did take a lot out of her. And then we've got another fellow who ran into the same problem, John Mylong, who plays the professor. And again, there's some question as to, and this is one of the confusing parts about Robot Monster, if he was strictly the professor or if he was the father. And for those of you that haven't seen this movie, we're going to spoil some stuff in this movie. So I'm going to warn you right up front. I think you're still going to want to see it, even if some of the ending is spoiled for you. But John is an interesting one. He's Austrian, and he left Austria-Hungary when the Nazis were coming to power in World War II. He naturalized here into the United States and was acting over here. He also ran into some problems with the McCarthy people as well. You know, they destroyed a lot of people's career, Joe McCarthy did with these communist hearings. If you were even implicated, your career was pretty much over. And it's a shame. John's not a bad actor. And he ended up playing when he came over to this country, in the 40s, he would play Nazis and Germans and Teutonic type characters and that sort of thing. And he was good at playing bad guys whenever they needed like an old Nazi officer or something like that. Now, our next two kids that we're going to see in this, and these are going to be basically our main people in here, Gregory Moffat, who plays Johnny, and Pamela Paulson, who plays little Carla. Neither one of them had much of an acting career. In fact, Johnny pretty much got out of the business not too long after, he got some roles as a kid and went on to other endeavors and has done well for himself. He's still around with us, and he still talks fondly about Robot Monster, and he took a really good positive attitude from all of this, because people always wonder, God, when you're in a movie that's got that is as infamous as Robot Monster, it must have been traumatic as a kid. He said he met some very talented people and some good people. I loved working on the set. It was a heck of a lot of fun, so he has very fond memories of it. Now Pamela Paulson, who plays little Carla, this was pretty much it for her. I mean, this is pretty much what she did. And I mean, she was so young when she did this. She struggles a little bit. I mean, again, I can't be critical of a little girl, in a movie, because I mean, she was so young. She was probably in a little deep on this one. Now, the last person I want to mention is George Barrows. And George Barrows, you're not going to recognize, because he's the guy dressed up in the gorilla costume. He is Roman, and he also plays the Great Guidance, who is the big boss of the romance. And again, this is about robot monsters who have come over from the moon to take over the planet. And the story deals with these Roy, Alice, the mother, and the professor, along with Johnny and Carla, are the last people on the planet. Actually, there were 8 altogether, but 2 of them get killed in the movie. You never meet them. You just hear that they get killed in the movie when they try to take off in a rocket ship to an orbiting laboratory, an orbiting platform that the United States has put into orbit. It's one of the effects that's sort of laughable, unfortunately. But they use a lot of stock footage in this film, and they use a lot of dinosaur footage, because one of the things that gets involved with this movie, and again, I'll probably be jumping around a little bit on this, is that the Romans are going out of their way to destroy all of the humans so that they can have the planet all to themselves. And again, even though they don't come out and say moon, the implication is there. It's very obvious that these were probably moon guys doing this. Now, you've got this story that starts out with little Johnny making his way up to a cave. And did I tell you where they shot most of this? They shot this movie in 4 days, and most of it was shot in Bronson Canyons. Yep, our good old friends Bronson Canyons. So we got a couple of big caves that we're going to see in this movie. And, of course, whenever a movie was shot in the 50s and had to have a cave, you went to Bronson Canyon. You sure did. Johnny finds these two scientists up there in the cave, and it's Roy and the professor. And his mother comes looking for him along with Alice, who immediately catches the eye of Roy. He's like, oh, wow, they're your sister. Wow, well, I got to get to know her. You know, and they're invited to dinner. And, you know, and Johnny has to go back and get his nap because they're all out on a picnic. The mother and Alice and Johnny and Carla are on a picnic, and they were supposed to take a lunch nap, and, you know, a nap after lunch. And Johnny had snuck away, and so they caught him. They said, you've got to come back, take your nap. And Roy says, hey, I had to do that too when I was a kid. So he says, well, I want to come back and see you guys. And he said, fine. You can come back, you know, as soon as you've had your nap, and we'll probably still be here. Well, all of a sudden now we've got a situation where we see Johnny waking up from his nap. All the rest of them are asleep there. And he's going to go up to the cave to see Roy and the professor. But when he gets up there, they're not there. And what's there is some equipment. And we have our billion bubble machine at work here. Yes, I know you've heard about that from the Robot Monster. This is some of the, you know, when you got $16,000 in your budget, I guess, you know, special effects, you're not going to do much. They got one of these old bubble machines from a dance hall, you know, sort of a Lawrence Welk type thing, which actually gets a credit in the movie. And you've got what looks like some radio equipment and an antenna and then a view screen and stuff and then bubbles all over the place at the entrance to this cave. And then out comes Roman. Of course, little Johnny hides so that Roman doesn't see him. And Roman is, and I'm sure you have heard about this, folks, but on the chance that some of you listening right now have not heard about this, Roman was supposed to be a robot. And Phil Tucker wanted a robot, but he couldn't get enough money in the budget to get a robot costume. So he calls up his friend George Barrows, and he says, George, I need some help. I said, I guess Roman is going to have to be sort of like a gorilla thing because he knew George had his own gorilla suit. So George said, sure, I'll help you out with the movie. And, you know, I'll be your Roman. And so he gets the gorilla costume. But when Tucker sees it, he goes, oh, that's not quite right. The head's not right. So what he does is he tells him, okay, don't wear the gorilla head. And he puts a space helmet on the gorilla. So you've got a man in a gorilla, you've got George Barrows in a gorilla costume wearing a space helmet. Now, inaccurately, it has been reported in a few books and on some of the documentaries that it's a gorilla suit with a diving helmet. And I'm here to say, I'm going to correct that because that is not what they wear. This is a space helmet, and it's a space helmet that you might recognize from a couple of other science fiction films from the 1950s. It's clearly a space helmet. It's got the little antennas on it and all of that sort of thing. So I don't know how somebody got it in their mind it was a diving helmet. It's not a diving helmet. So Phil got a good deal on this space helmet, puts it on George's gorilla costume, and then they just sort of fuzz out the lens, you know, where the faceplate is, so you can't really see it's a human being in there. And you can sort of make out a little bit of a face, but not really. And when you see the great guidance that he talks to on the view screen, you can't see his face at all. It's all blacked out. Now, a fellow by the name of John Brown does the voice for Roman and the great guidance, a very deep, booming type voice. And then, you know, okay, so what we've got here, we've got, now we meet Roman and the bubble machine, and there's a little bit of radio equipment, and Johnny runs back to this house that they're living in, but it looks like the ruins of a house. It doesn't even have a roof on it, and there is Mother, and there is Alice, and there is Carla, and the professor, and now the professor is the father. He's now the father of the family, and Roy is a scientist that... he's not there when Johnny gets back. He's out hunting up the Roman. And he comes back later. He's with the other two guys that also survived. And he is supposed to be not only Alice's sort of unofficial boyfriend, but they collaborate together as scientists because apparently Alice has this brilliant mind when it comes to technology and things of that nature. And that plays a little bit into the story because Roy and Alice have had a big fight. And when Roy comes back, she is still mad at him and still pouting a little bit. And he tells the professor, and this is where it gets a little confusing because it's, you know, is he the father or is he not the father? Because that's what we think he is. But, you know, in the beginning, he was the professor. So this is where it gets a little, the storyline and the script gets a little screwy. I'll be a little critical there. It can be a little confusing for a kid. And, you know, you're trying to sort it as an adult. It's a little easier to sort it out and sort of shake your head and think, well, I think they're just sort of in a hurry to make the movie. Anyway, we've got a series of events that happen now. We've got Roman trying to hunt down the last remaining 8 people on the planet. These 6, and then the 2 guys who we never see. They are trying to escape in a rocket ship to get up to this space platform, which is like a space lab, like what the old Skylab was. And because they have found this vaccine that will help insulate them against this ray that the Romans are using to kill all of the people on Earth. It makes them invulnerable to it. Now, we find out, see, that the father, who is the professor or whatever, has invented this vaccine. He was trying to discover a vaccine that would prevent disease. All disease would be gone, and as a sort of a side effect, it protects them against this weapon that the Romans have been using against them. Well, when the 2 guys take off in the rocket ship, we find out the rocket ship gets blown up immediately off the pad because the Romans, you know, catch on to it. And we have this little cat and mouse game now between the Romans and the Great Guidance, who is pushing the Roman to finish the job and get rid of the rest of these people. And, you know, the Roman is, I will. They have this device. The other people have this device that also keeps them safe where the Romans have a hard time finding them with their electronic surveillance equipment, because Alice has come up with this gizmo that we see sort of sparking around in the background at the ruins of this house to protect them and sort of shield them from the watchful eyes of the Roman. Even though they can talk to him on the view screen, Roman can't figure out where they are. Now, here's the part where the story gets a little goofy. It gets a little strange because, and I'm going to be really skipping around here a little bit. We're going to skip up a little bit. But Roy and Alice finally, you know, they are outside of the protected zone. And they have this, what I want to say is one of the most odd and unusual love scenes I've ever seen. It's crazy because the Roman is around nearby. They've got to keep quiet so he doesn't hear them. And so they're talking in sign language and having this love scene in sign language. I know it sounds bizarre, but there's a lot about this movie that's pretty bizarre. And, you know, they obviously overcome their differences so that when they get back to the house, when they're able to sneak back to the house, Roy says to the professor, who is also the father, he says, I want to marry Alice, and I want you to do the ceremony. And the professor, so we have a nice little scene with them getting married, but it's so odd because Roy takes off his shirt, which is all ripped, and so he is getting married bare-chested. Like I said, they do everything they can to show this guy bare-chested. Now, this is just one example of, it seems like for people that have to stay behind this protective barrier, they go outside a whole lot. They really do. They really expose themselves as much as they can to this guy. Well, as it turns out, the two get married and they go off on their honeymoon outside of the protective zone, I guess, so they can have some fun, so to speak. I got to be careful because this, you know, kids are listening to the show and kids are probably watching this movie, and they dance around that quite a bit. But Alice and Roy, while they have their honeymoon, are discovered by Roman. Roy gets knocked out, and Roman takes Alice. Now, this is supposed to be a robot monster that's supposed to kill every human it comes across, but he doesn't kill Roy. He almost kills Roy, but Alice jumps on him, and then he stops, and you can almost hear the violins in the background. He is smitten by Alice, and he takes her back to the cave. Well, now they got to try to save Alice, and little Johnny figures, okay, look, here's my plan, and Johnny comes up with all the plans in this movie, which makes it surprisingly like a knockoff of Invaders from Mars, if you think about it, you know, because the little kid was at the center of attention and, you know, helped the military beat the Martians in that movie. I think maybe Phil might have been a little influenced by that film. But Johnny is going to be a decoy, and then the professor and mom can go in there and get Alice and save her. But none of it works because Roy ends up getting killed. Mom ends up getting killed. The professor ends up getting killed. And Alice is getting hauled off by the Roman. But after some lengthy conversations between Alice and Roman, she gets killed as well because Roman has fallen in love with Alice. And the great guidance is like, I can't believe this guy. I send him down to finish killing these people. He can't even do that. So he kills Roman and comes down to finish the job. And he finishes the job. And Johnny gets it. Everybody gets it. But then Johnny wakes up because it's all been a dream. Oh, yes, big spoiler. It's all been a dream. This makes it also suspiciously like Invaders from Mars because we get everybody back together again. And we got Roy. We've got Alice. We got the professor. Now Roy and Alice, I mean, Roy and the professor are two scientists again. And they're going to have dinner with the family. And everything's back to normal again. And as they all leave, we see the entrance to the cave, and all of a sudden bubbles start coming out of it, and we hear the ominous music, and out comes one Roman, and then another Roman, and then another Roman, and then another. And again, folks, this is so much like Invaders from Mars, because, you know, that movie was about a little kid. He has this nightmare which involves Martians invading the planet. It all ends up being a dream, and as he wakes up from the dream, and we go off to that part of the movie at the end, we see the Martians are really invading. This is just too much like that. And I think probably a lot of people who saw this film figured that one out as well. Anyway, folks, as goofy as it sounds, and I jumped all over the map on this one, it is one of those that it's so good, it's so bad, it's good. It's fun, but you've got to overlook some of the craziness of the writing. At times, it's too serious. The writing is a little too philosophical. Tries to be too artsy, and they only had $16,000. And the effects are sort of laughable. But it's just worth it to watch the movie that a lot of people have been talking about for 65 years just to see this. If you've not seen it, it's like some of Ed Wood's better films. It's just worth it to just say, yeah, I saw Robot Monster. Again, it's a Mystery Science Theater type film. I think it was one of the first ones they spoofed, if I remember correctly. And, it shows up quite a bit on the monster movie. It showed up a lot on the monster movie matinee circuit when I was a kid growing up. And we just like it because it was just sort of dumb. It was sort of goofy. So I'm going to recommend that if you've not seen Robot Monster, try to find a copy of it and sit down and watch Robot Monster 1953. It is an all-time cult classic. It's just one of those films that even on its initial release, I mean, you know, it made its investors almost $1 million off of a $16,000, or made them $1 million off a $16,000 investment. So there was something out there that struck a chord with individuals when they first saw it. And it's become a very popular collector's item for those of us that are into cult films and that sort of thing. Robot Monster, 1953. Hey, folks, we hope you have a happy new year. Look forward to starting off a new year with you next Monday with another classic monster movie out of my ditty sack. And we'll keep you in suspense as to what it is. As I've been teasing, we've got Mark and Madeline in the next few weeks to do some special shows with us. Again, love it when they sit in with us. And I ask you, if you would visit projectentertainmentnetwork.com, check out the store up there. We've got some great merchandise and stuff up there, but also check out the 19 other podcasts that we have on PEN, because you're going to find all kinds of cool stuff up there. It's not just horror. We've got a lot of horror podcasts, but we've got a lot of other things too that you ought to be interested in. So check it out at projectentertainmentnetwork.com. And don't forget, now you can find us. You can find all of the episodes of Monster Attack on Radio Public and check them out. Good, strong signal. It's a very clean, stable signal. And we are really tickled to death to be a part of the Radio Public family. Folks, have a great week, and we will see you next Monday on Monster Attack.
covering 5 and 0.
What kind of stars can you hear each week on the Curtain Jerkers Wrestling Podcast? Booker Max Burton presides over our panel of wrestling analysts. Ring announcer Walter Ball. South Florida indie correspondent Steve Mesa. Northeast indie correspondent The Viking Brian Burke. Classic feuds dissected. Indie rivalry and common sense. It's the stable that shoots while it works. Fridays at 6:05 on Superstation PEN on the Curtain Jerkers Wrestling Podcast.
This has been an exclusive presentation of the Project Entertainment Network.